some red matting. She shook her head weakly, then lifted it and looked at the old woman.
"Don't worry about me, Granny. You should be careful yourself. Your voice sounds a bit husky."
Osugi put a pot of rice on the brazier to make gruel.
"It's nothing," she said. "But you're sick. You have to eat properly so you'll feel strong when the boat comes in."
Otsu held back a tear and looked out to sea. There were some boats fishing for octopus and a couple of cargo vessels. The ship from Sakai was nowhere to be seen.
"It's getting late," said Osugi. "They said the ship would be here before evening."
There was a hint of complaint in her voice. News of the departure of Musashi's ship had spread rapidly. When it reached Jotaro and Himeji, he sent a messenger to tell Osugi. She, in turn, had hurried straight to the Shippoji, where Otsu lay ill, suffering from the effects of the beating the old woman had given her. Since that night, Osugi had begged forgiveness so often and tearfully that listening to her had come to be rather a burden for Otsu. Otsu did not hold her responsible for her sickness. She thought it was a recurrence of the malady that had kept her confined for several months at Lord Karasumaru's house in Kyoto. In the mornings and evenings, she coughed a lot and had a slight fever. And she lost weight, which made her face more beautiful than ever, but it was an excessively delicate beauty and saddened those who met and talked with her. Still, her eyes shone. For one thing, she was happy about the change that had come over Osugi. Having finally understood that she had been mistaken about Otsu and Musashi, the Honiden Dowager was like a woman reborn. And Otsu had hope, springing from the certainty that the day was near when she would see Musashi again. Osugi had said,
"To atone for all the unhappiness I've caused you, I'm going to get down on my hands and knees and beg Musashi to set things right. I'll bow. I'll apologize. I'll persuade him."
After announcing to her own family and the whole village that Matahachi's betrothal to Otsu was nullified, she destroyed the document recording the promise to marry. From then on, she made it her business to tell one and all that the only person who would be a proper and fitting husband for Otsu was Musashi. Since the village had changed, the person Otsu knew best in Miyamoto was Osugi, who took it upon herself to nurse the girl back to health, calling each morning and evening at the Shippoji with the same solicitous questions.
"Have you eaten? Did you take your medicine? How do you feel?"
One day, she said with tears in her eyes,
"If you hadn't come back to life that night in the cave, I would have wanted to die there too."
The old woman had never before hesitated to bend the truth or tell outright lies, one of the last of which turned out to be about Ogin's being in Sayo. In fact, no one had seen or heard from Ogin for years. All that was known was that she had married and gone to another province. So at first, Otsu found Osugi's protestations unbelievable. Even if she was sincere, it seemed likely her remorse would wear off after a time. But as days turned into weeks, she grew more devoted and more attentive to Otsu.
"I never dreamed she was such a good person at heart," was how Otsu came to think of her.
And since Osugi's newfound warmth and kindness extended to everyone around her, this sentiment was widely shared by both the family and the villagers, though many expressed their astonishment less delicately, saying things like,
"What do you suppose got into the old hag?"
Even Osugi marveled at how kind everyone was to her now. It used to be that even those people closest to her were inclined to cringe at the very sight of her. Now they all smiled and spoke cordially. At last, at an age when simply being alive was something to be thankful for, she was learning for the first time what it was like to be loved and respected by others. One acquaintance asked frankly,
"What happened to you? Your face looks more attractive every time I see you."
"Maybe so,"
thought Osugi later that same day, looking at herself in her mirror. The past had left its mark. When she went away from the village, there had still been black hair mixed with gray. Now it was all white. She didn't mind, for she believed that her heart, at least, was free of blackness now. The ship Musashi was on made a regular overnight stop at Shikama to discharge and take on cargo. Yesterday, after telling Otsu this, Osugi had asked,
"What are you going to do?"
"I'm going to be there, of course."
"In that case, I'll go too."
Otsu got up from her sickbed, and they were on their way within the hour. It took them until late afternoon to walk to Himeji. All the while, Osugi hovered over Otsu as though she were a child. At Aoki Tanzaemon's house that night, plans were laid to hold a congratulatory dinner at Himeji Castle for Musashi. It was assumed that because of his previous experience at the castle, he would now deem it an honor to be fated in this fashion. Even Jotaro thought so. It was also decided, in consultation with Tanzaemon's fellow samurai, that it wouldn't do for Otsu to be seen openly with Musashi. People might get the idea she was his secret lover. Tanzaemon told Otsu and Osugi the gist of this and suggested the boat as a way for Otsu to be present but at the same time not be a source of embarrassing gossip. The sea darkened and the color faded from the sky. Stars began to twinkle. Near the dyer's house where Otsu lived, a contingent of some 20 samurai from Himeji had been waiting since mid-afternoon to welcome Musashi.
"Maybe this is the wrong day," remarked one of them.
"No, don't worry," said another. "I sent a man to Kobayashi's local agent to make sure."
"Hey, isn't that it? It looks like the right kind of sail."
Noisily, they moved closer to the water's edge. Jotaro left them and ran off to the small boat in the estuary.
"Otsu! Granny! The ship's in sight! Musashi's ship!"
he shouted to the excited women.
"Did you really see it? Where?"
asked Otsu. She nearly fell overboard as she got to her feet.
"Be careful,"
warned Osugi, grabbing her from behind. They stood side by side, eyes searching the darkness. Gradually, a tiny distant spot grew into a large sail, black in the starlight and seemingly gliding right into their eyes.
"That's it!"
cried Jotaro.
"Hurry, grab the skull," said Otsu. "Take us out to the ship."
"There's no need to rush. One of the samurai on the beach will row out and get Musashi."
"Then we have to go now. Once he's with that bunch, there won't be a chance for Otsu to talk to him."
"We can't do that. They'll all see her."
"You spend too much time worrying about what other samurai will think, and that's the reason we're stuck away in this little boat. If you ask me, we should have waited at the dyer's house."
"No, you're wrong. You don't realize how people talk."
"Relax.
My father and I'll find a way to bring him here."
He stopped to think for a fraction of a minute.
"When he gets to shore, he'll go to the dyer's house for a short rest. I'll get to him then and see to it that he comes here to you. Just wait here. I'll be back soon."
He rushed off toward the beach.
"Try to get a little rest," said Osugi.
Though Otsu lay down obediently, she seemed to have trouble catching her breath.
"Cough bothering you again?"
asked Osugi gently. She knelt and rubbed the girl's back.
"Don't worry. Musashi'll be here before long."
"Thank you. I'm all right now."
Once her coughing had subsided, she patted and smoothed her hair, trying to make herself a little more presentable. As time passed and Musashi failed to appear, Osugi grew fidgety. Leaving Otsu in the boat, she went up on the bank. When she was out of sight, Otsu pushed her pallet and pillow behind some matting, retied her obi, and straightened her kimono. The palpitations of her heart seemed in no way different from what she had experienced as a girl of 17 or 18. The red light of the small beacon fire suspended near the prow pierced her heart with warmth. Stretching her delicate white arm over the gunwale, she moistened her comb and ran it through her hair again. Then she applied some powder to her cheeks, but so lightly that it was nearly undetectable. After all, she thought, even samurai, when suddenly summoned from a deep sleep into their lordship's presence, would sometimes sneak into a dressing room and cover up their pallor with a little rouge. What really troubled her was the question of what she would say to him. Fearfully, she thought of becoming tongue-tied, as she had when she had seen him at other times. She didn't want to say anything that would upset him, so she had to be particularly careful about that. He was on his way to a bout. The whole country was talking about it. At this important moment in her life, Otsu did not believe he would lose to Kojiro, yet it was not absolutely certain he would win. Accidents could happen. If she did something wrong today, and if Musashi was killed later, she would regret it for the rest of her life. Nothing would be left for her but to cry herself to death, hoping, like the ancient Chinese emperor, to be joined with her loved one in the next life. She must say what she had to say, no matter what he himself might say or do. She had mustered the strength to come this far. Now the meeting was near at hand, and her pulse raced wildly. With so many things on her mind, the words she wanted to say would not take form. Osugi had no such problem. She was choosing the words she would use to apologize for misunderstanding and hatred, to unburden her heart and beg forgiveness. As proof of her sincerity, she would see that Otsu's life was entrusted to Musashi. The darkness was broken only by an occasional reflection from the water, and it was quiet until Jotaro's running footsteps became audible.
"You've finally come, have you?" said Osugi, who was still standing on the bank. "Where's Musashi?"
"Granny, I'm sorry."
"You're sorry? What does that mean?"
"Just listen. I'll explain everything."
"I don't want explanations. Is Musashi coming or isn't he?"
"He's not coming."
"Not coming?"
Her voice was empty and full of disappointment. Jotaro, looking very awkward, related what had happened, namely that when a samurai had rowed out to the ship, he was told that it wasn't stopping there. There were no passengers wanting to get off at Shikama. The cargo had been taken off by lighter. The samurai had asked to see Musashi, who came to the side of the ship and talked with the man, but said disembarking was out of the question. Both he and the captain wanted to reach Kokura as quickly as possible. By the time the samurai returned to the beach with this message, the ship was already heading out to the open sea again.
"You can't even see it anymore," said Jotaro dejectedly. "It's already rounded the pine woods at the other end of the beach. I'm sorry. Nobody's to blame."
"Why didn't you go out in the boat with the samurai?"
"I didn't think. Anyway, there's nothing we can do. No use talking about it now."
"I suppose you're right, but what a shame. What are we going to tell Otsu?"
"You'll have to do it, Jotaro. I haven't the heart."
"You can tell her exactly what happened, but try to calm her first, or her sickness might get worse."
But there was no need for Jotaro to explain. Otsu, seated behind a piece of matting, had heard everything. The lapping of the water against the side of the boat seemed to resign her heart to suffering.
"If I missed him tonight," she thought, "I'll see him another day on another beach."
She thought she understood why Musashi was set against leaving the ship. Throughout western Honshu and Kyushu, Sasaki Kojiro was acknowledged to be the greatest of all swordsmen. In challenging his primacy, Musashi would be burning with determination to win. His mind would be on that. Only that.
"To think that he was so near," she sighed.
Tears streaming down her cheeks, she gazed after the invisible sail, making its way slowly westward. She leaned disconsolately against the boat rail. Then, for the first time, she became conscious of an enormous force swelling up with her tears. Despite her frailness, somewhere deep in her being was a font of superhuman strength. Though she had not realized it, her willpower was indomitable and had enabled her to persevere through the long years of illness and anguish. Fresh blood infused her cheeks, giving them new life.
"Granny, Jotaro!"
They came down the bank slowly, Jotaro asking, "What is it, Otsu?"
"I heard you talking."
"Oh?"
"Yes. But I'm not going to cry about it anymore. I'll go to Kokura. I'll see the bout for myself. We can't take it for granted Musashi will win. If he doesn't, I intend to receive his ashes and bring them back with me."
"But you're sick."
"Sick?"
She'd pushed the very idea from her mind. She seemed filled with the vitality transcending the weakness of her body.
"Don't think about it. I'm perfectly all right. Well, maybe I'm a little sick. But until I see how the bout turns out, I'm determined not to die,"
were the words that nearly escaped her lips. She stifled them and busied herself making preparations for her journey. When she was ready, she got out of the boat all by herself, though she had to cling tightly to the rail in order to do so. A Falcon and a Woman. At the time of the Battle of Sekigahara, Kokura had been the site of a fortress commanded by Lord Mori Matsunobu of Iki. Since then, the castle had been rebuilt and enlarged and acquired a new lord. Its towers and glistening white walls bespoke the great power and dignity of the House of Hosokawa, headed now by Tadatoshi, who had succeeded his father, Tadaoki. In the short time since Kojiro's arrival, the Gunryu style, developed on the foundation he had learned from Toda Seigen and Kanemaki Jisai, had swept over all Kyushu. Men even came from Shikoku to study under him, hoping that after a year or two of training they would be awarded a certificate and receive sanction to return home as teachers of this new style. Kojiro enjoyed the esteem of those around him, including Tadatoshi, who had been heard to remark with satisfaction, "I found myself a very good swordsman." In every quarter of the extensive Hosokawa household, it was agreed that Kojiro was a person of outstanding character. And when he traveled between his home and the castle, he did so in style, attended by 7 lancers. People went out of their way to approach him and pay their respects. Until his coming, Ujiie Magoshiro, a practitioner of the Shinkage style, had been the clan's chief sword instructor, but his star dimmed rapidly as Kojiro's grew more brilliant. Kojiro treated him magniloquently. To Lord Tadatoshi, he had said, "You mustn't let Ujiie go. While his style is not flashy, it does have a certain maturity we younger men lack." He suggested that he and Magoshiro give lessons in the castle's dojo on alternate days, and this was put into practice. At one point, Tadatoshi said, "Kojiro says Magoshiro's method is not flashy, but mature. Magoshiro says Kojiro is a genius with whom he cannot match swords. Who is right? I'd like to see a demonstration." The two men agreed to subsequently face each other with wooden swords in his lordship's presence. At the first opportunity, Kojiro discarded his weapon and, seating himself at his opponent's feet, announced, "I'm no match for you. Forgive my presumption."
"Don't be modest," replied Magoshiro. "I'm the one who's not a worthy opponent."
Witnesses were divided as to whether Kojiro acted out of compassion or self-interest. In any case, his reputation rose still higher. Kojiro's attitude toward Magoshiro remained charitable, but whenever someone made favorable mention of Musashi's growing fame in Edo and Kyoto, he was quick to set him straight.
"Musashi?"
he would say with disdain.
"Oh, he's been crafty enough to make something of a name for himself. He talks about his two-sword style, I'm told.
He's always had a certain natural ability. I doubt whether there's anybody in Kyoto or Osaka who could defeat him.
He always made it appear that he was restraining himself from saying more. An experienced warrior visiting Kojiro's house one day said,
I've never met the man, but people say this Miyamoto Musashi is the greatest swordsman since Koizumi and Tsukahara, with the exception of Yagyu Sekishusai, of course. Everybody seems to think that if he's not the greatest swordsman, he's at least reached the level of a master.
Kojiro laughed, and the color rose in his face.
Well, people are blind, he said bitingly, so I suppose some consider him a great man or an expert swordsman. That just goes to show you how far the art of war has declined, with regard to both style and personal conduct. We live in an age when a clever publicity seeker can rule the roost, at least as far as ordinary people are concerned. Needless to say, I look at it differently. I saw Musashi trying to sell himself in Kyoto some years ago. He gave an exhibition of his brutality and cravenness in his bout with the Yoshioka school at Ichijoji. Cravenness is not a low enough word for the likes of him. All right, so he was outnumbered, but what did he do? He showed his back at the earliest possible moment. Considering his past and his overweening ambition, I see him as a man not worth spitting on. Aha! If a man who spends his life trying to learn the art of war is an expert, then I suppose Musashi's an expert. But a master of the sword? No, not that.
He obviously took praise of Musashi as a personal affront, but his insistence on winning anyone and everyone over to his point of view was so vehement that even his staunchest admirers began to wonder. Eventually, the word got around that there was a long-standing enmity between Musashi and Kojiro. Before long, rumors of a match were flying. It was at Lord Tadatoshi's order that Kojiro had finally issued a challenge. In the several months since then, the entire Hosokawa fief had buzzed with speculation as to when the fight would be held and how it would turn out. Iwama Kakube, now well along in years, called on Kojiro morning and evening whenever he could find the slightest excuse. On an evening early in the fourth month, when even the pink double-petal cherry blossoms had fallen, Kakube walked through Kojiro's front garden, past bright red azaleas blooming in the shadows of ornamental rocks. He was shown to an inner room lit only by the falling light of the evening sun.
"Ah, Master Iwama, good to see you,"
said Kojiro, who was standing just outside, feeding the falcon on his fist.
"I have news for you," said Kakube, still standing. "The clan council discussed the place for the bout today in his lordship's presence and reached a decision."
"Have a seat," said an attendant from the adjacent room.
With no more than a grunt of thanks, Kakube sat down and continued.
"A number of sites were suggested, among them Kikunonagahama and the bank of the Murasaki River, but they were all rejected because they were too small or too accessible to the public. We could put up bamboo fencing, of course, but even that wouldn't prevent the riverbank from being overrun by swarms of people looking for thrills."
"I see," replied Kojiro, still intently watching the falcon's eyes and beak. Kakube, expecting his report to be received more or less with bated breath, was crestfallen. A guest would not normally do such a thing, but Kakube said,
"Come inside. This is nothing to be talking about while you're standing out there."
"In a minute," Kojiro said casually. "I want to finish feeding the bird."
"Is that the falcon Lord Tadatoshi gave you after you went hunting together last fall?"
"Yes. Its name is Amayumi. The more I get used to it, the better I like it." He threw away the rest of the food and, winding up the red-tasseled cord attached to the bird's neck, said to the young attendant behind him, "Here, Tatsunosuke, put it back in its cage." The bird was passed from fist to fist, and Tatsunosuke started across the spacious garden.
Beyond the customary man-made hillock was a grove of pines, bordered on the other side by a fence. The compound lay along the Itatsu River. Many other Hosokawa vassals lived in the vicinity. "Forgive me for making you wait," said Kojiro.
"Think nothing of it. I'm not exactly an outsider. When I come here, it's almost like being at my son's house."
A maid of 20 or so came in and gracefully poured tea. With a glance at the guest, she invited him to have a cup. Kakube shook his head admiringly.
"It's good to see you, Omitsu. You're always so pretty."
She blushed down to the collar of her kimono.
"And you're always making fun of me," she replied, before quickly slipping out of the room.
Kakube said,
"You say the more you get used to your falcon, the better you like it. What about Omitsu? Wouldn't it be better to have her at your side, rather than a bird of prey? I've been meaning to ask you about your intentions regarding her."
"Has she by any chance secretly visited your house at one time or another?"
"I'll admit, she did come to talk to me."
"Stupid woman! She hasn't said a word about it to me!"
He shot an angry glance at the white shoji.
"Don't let it upset you. There's no reason why she shouldn't come."
He waited until he thought Kojiro's eyes had softened a little, then went on.
"It's only natural for a woman to worry. I don't think she doubts your affection for her, but anybody in her position would worry about the future. I mean, what's to become of her?"
"I suppose she told you everything?"
"Why shouldn't she? It's the most ordinary thing in the world to happen between a man and a woman. One of these days, you'll want to get married. You have this big house and lots of servants. Why not?"
"Can't you imagine what people would say if I married a girl I'd previously had in my house as a maid?"
"Does it really make any difference? You certainly can't throw her aside now. If she weren't a suitable bride for you, it might be awkward, but she's of good blood, isn't she? I'm told she's the niece of Ono Tadaki."
"That's correct."
"And you met her when you went to Tadaki's dojo and opened his eyes to the sad state his school of swordsmanship was in."
"Yes. I'm not proud of it, but I can't keep it from someone as close to me as you are. I'd planned to tell you the whole story sooner or later. As you say, it happened after my bout with Tadaki. It was already dark when I started for home, and Omitsu, she was living with her uncle at the time, brought a small lantern and walked down Saikachi Slope with me. Without giving it a thought, I flirted with her a bit along the way, but she took me seriously. After Tadaki disappeared, she came to see me and..."
Now it was Kakube's turn to be embarrassed. He waved his hand to let his protege know he had heard enough. Actually, he had not known until very recently that Kojiro had taken the girl in before leaving Edo for Kokura. He was surprised not only at his own naivete, but also at Kojiro's ability to attract a woman, have an affair with her, and keep the whole thing secret.
"Leave everything to me," he said. "At the moment, it would be rather inappropriate for you to announce your marriage. First things first. It can be done after your bout."
Like so many others, he was confident that final justification for Kojiro's fame and position would be forthcoming within a few days. Remembering why he'd come, he went on,
"As I said, the council has decided the location for the bout. Since one requirement was that it be within Lord Tadatoshi's domain, but somewhere that crowds can't get to easily, it was agreed that an island would be ideal. The island chosen is a small one called Funashima, between Shimonoseki and Moji."
He looked thoughtful for a minute, then said,
"I wonder if it wouldn't be wise to look the terrain over before Musashi arrives. It might give you a certain advantage."
His reasoning was that from a knowledge of the lay of the land, a swordsman would have an idea of how the fighting would proceed, how tightly to tie his sandals, how to make use of the terrain and the position of the sun. At the very least, Kojiro would have a sense of security, which would be impossible if he were entering the place for the first time. He suggested they hire a fishing boat and go out to look at Funashima the next day. Kojiro disagreed.
The whole point of the art of war is to be quick to seize an opening. Even when a man takes precautions, it often happens that his opponent will have anticipated them and devised means of offsetting them. It's much better to approach the situation with an open mind and move with perfect freedom.
Seeing the logic of this argument, Kakube made no more mention of going to Funashima. Summoned by Kojiro, Omitsu served them sake, and the two men drank and chatted until late in the evening. From the relaxed way in which Kakube sipped his sake, it was evident that he was pleased with life, and felt that his efforts to assist Kojiro had been rewarded. Rather like a proud father, he said,
"I think it's all right to tell Omitsu. When this is over, we can invite her relatives and friends here for the marriage ceremony. It's a fine thing for you to be devoted to your sword, but you must also have a family if your name is to be carried on. When you're married, I'll feel I've done my duty by you."
Unlike the happy old retainer with many years of service, Kojiro showed no signs of drunkenness. But then he was prone to silence these days anyway. Once the bout had been decided on, Kakube had suggested and Tadatoshi had agreed to release Kojiro from his duties. He had enjoyed the unaccustomed leisure at first, but as the day approached and more people came to call, he found himself forced to entertain them. Recently, times when he could rest had become few. Still, he was reluctant to shut himself away and have people turn back at the gate. If he did that, people would think he'd lost his composure. The idea that came to him was to go out into the country every day, his falcon on his fist. In nice weather, hiking over field and mountain with only the bird for a companion did his spirit good. When the falcon's alert azure eyes spotted a victim in the sky, Kojiro would release it. Then his own eyes, equally alert, would follow it as it rose and swooped down on its quarry. Until the feathers began to drift to earth, he remained breathless, transfixed, as though he himself were the falcon.
"Good! That's the way!"
he exclaimed when the falcon made the kill. He had learned much from this bird of prey, and as a result of these hunting excursions, his face showed more confidence with the passage of each day. Returning home in the evening, he was met by Omitsu's eyes, swollen from crying. It hurt him to observe her efforts to disguise this. To him, losing to Musashi was inconceivable. Nevertheless, the question of what would happen to her if he was killed crept into his mind. So did the image of his dead mother, to whom he had given scarcely a thought for years. And each night, as he was falling asleep, a vision of the falcon's azure eyes and the swollen eyes of Omitsu came to visit him, jumbled in an odd way with a fleeting memory of his mother's face. Before the 13th day. Shimonoseki, Moji, the castle town of Kokura. During the past several days, many travelers had come, but few had left. The inns were all full, and horses were lined up side by side at the hitching posts outside. The command issued by the castle said,
"On the 13th day of this month, at 8 o'clock in the morning, on Funashima in the Nagato Straits of Buzen, Sasaki Kojiro Ganryu, a samurai of this fief, will at his lordship's bidding fight a bout with Miyamoto Musashi Masana, a ronin from the province of Mimasaka. It is strictly forbidden for supporters of either swordsman to go to his aid or set forth on the water between the mainland and Funashima. Until 10 o'clock on the morning of the 13th, no sightseeing vessels,
passenger ships, and fishing boats will be permitted to enter the straits. Fourth month, 1612. The announcement was posted conspicuously on bulletin boards at all major intersections, piers, and gathering places.
The 13th? That's the day after tomorrow, isn't it? People from all over will want to see the bout so they can go home and talk about it.
Of course they will. But how's anybody going to see a fight taking place on an island 2 miles from shore?
Well, if you go to the top of Mount Kazashi, you can see the pine trees on Funashima. People will come anyway, just to gawk at the boats and crowds in Buzen and Nagato.
I hope the weather stays good. Because of the restriction of shipping activities, boatmen who might otherwise have been turning a tidy profit were doing poorly. Travelers and townsmen, however, took it in their stride, busily searching out vantage points from which they might catch a glimpse of the excitement on Funashima. About noon on the 11th, a woman giving breast to her baby was pacing back and forth in front of a one-tray eatery where the road from Moji entered Kokura. The baby, tired from traveling, would not stop crying.
"Sleepy? Take a little nap now. There, there. Sleep. Sleep."
Akemi patted her foot rhythmically on the ground. She wore no makeup. With a baby to nurse, her life had changed considerably, but there was nothing in her present circumstances that she regretted. Matahachi came out of the shop, wearing a sleeveless kimono of subdued color. The only hint of the days when he had aspired to becoming a priest was the bandana on his head, hiding the once-shaven head.
"Oh my, what's this?" he said. "Still crying? You should be sleeping. Go on, Akemi. I'll take him while you eat. Eat a lot, so you'll have plenty of milk."
Taking the child in his arms, he began crooning a soft lullaby.
"Well, this is a surprise," came a voice from behind him. "Huh?"
Matachi stared at the man, unable to place him.
"I'm Ichinomiya Genpachi. We met several years ago at the pine forest near Gojo Avenue in Kyoto. I guess you don't remember me."
When Matachi continued to stare blankly at him, Genpachi said,
"You were going around calling yourself Sasaki Kojiro."
"Oh!" Matachi gasped loudly. "The monk with the staff!"
"That's right. Good to see you again."
Matachi hastened to bow, which awakened the baby.
"Now, let's not start crying again," he pleaded.
"I wonder," said Genpachi, "if you could tell me where Kojiro's house is. I understand he lives here in Kokura."
"Sorry, I have no idea. I just got here myself."
Two samurai's attendants emerged from the shop, and one said to Genpachi,
"If you're looking for Kojiro's house, it's right by the Itatsu River. We'll show you the way if you like."
"Very kind of you. Goodbye, Matahachi. See you again."
The samurai walked off, and Genpachi fell in step with them. Matahachi, noticing the dirt and grime clinging to the man's clothes, thought,
"I wonder if he's come all the way from Kozuke."
He was deeply impressed that news of the bout had spread to such faraway places. Then the memory of the encounter with Genpachi flowed through his mind, and he shuddered. How worthless, how shallow, how shameless he'd been in those days. To think he had actually been brazen enough to try to pass off the certificate from the Chūjō school as his own, to impersonate... Still, that he could see how churlish he had been was a hopeful sign. At least he'd changed since then.
"I suppose," he thought, "even a stupid fool like me can improve if he stays awake and tries."
Hearing the baby crying again, Akemi bolted her meal and rushed outdoors.
"Sorry," she said. "I'll take him now."
Having placed the baby on Akemi's back, Matahachi hung a candy peddler's box from his shoulder and prepared to forge on. A number of passers-by looked enviously at this poor but apparently happy couple. An elderly, genteel-looking woman approached and said,
"What a lovely baby! How old is he? Oh, look, he's laughing.
As if on command, the manservant accompanying her stooped and peered at the baby's face. They all walked together for a way. Then, as Matahachi and Akemi started to turn into a side street to look for an inn, the woman said,
"Oh, are you going that way?"
She bade them goodbye, and almost as an afterthought, asked,
"You seem to be travelers, too, but would you happen to know where Sasaki Kojiro's house is?"
Matahachi imparted the information he had just heard from the two attendants. As he watched her go off, he mumbled gloomily,
"I wonder what my mother's doing these days."
Now that he had a child of his own, he had begun to appreciate her feelings.
"Come on, let's go," said Akemi.
Matahachi stood and stared vacantly at the old woman. She was about the same age as Osugi. Kojiro's house was full of guests.
"It's a great opportunity for him.
Yes, this'll make his reputation once and for all.
He'll be known everywhere."
"True enough, but we mustn't forget who his opponent is. Gunryu will have to be very careful."
Many had arrived the previous night, and callers spilled out into the great entrance hall, the side entrances, the outside corridors. Some hailed from Kyoto or Osaka, others from western Honshu, one from the village of Jokyoji in distant Echizen. Since there weren't enough servants in the household, Kakube had sent some of his to help out. Samurai who were studying under Kojiro came and went, their faces eager with anticipation. All these friends, all these disciples, had one thing in common. Whether they knew Musashi or not, he was the enemy. Particularly virulent in their hatred were the provincial samurai who had at one time or another studied the methods of the Yoshioka school. The humiliation of the defeat at Ichijoji gnawed at their minds and hearts. Moreover, the single-minded determination with which Musashi had pursued his career was such that he had made himself many enemies. Kojiro's students despised him as a matter of course. A young samurai led a recent arrival from the entrance hall into the crowded parlor and announced,
"This man has made the trip from Kozuke."
The man said, "My name is Ichinomiya Genpachi," and modestly took his place among them. A murmur of admiration and respect went around the room, for Kozuke lay 1,000 miles to the northeast. Genpachi asked that a talisman he had brought from Mount Haku'un be placed on the household altar, and there were more murmurs of approval.
"The weather will be good on the 13th,
remarked one man, glancing out under the eaves at the flaming evening sun. "Today's the 11th, tomorrow the 12th, the next day." Addressing Genpachi, one guest said,
"I think your coming so far to say a prayer for Kojiro's success is quite remarkable. Do you have some connection with him?"
"I'm a retainer of the House of Kusanagi in Shimonida. My late master, Kusanagi Tenki, was the nephew of Kanemaki Jisai. Tenki knew Kojiro when Kojiro was still a young boy."
"I'd heard Kojiro studied under Jisai."
"That's true. Kojiro came from the same school as Ito Itosai. I've heard Itosai say many times that Kojiro was a brilliant fighter." He went on to recount how Kojiro had chosen to reject Jisai's certificate and create a style of his own. He told, too, of how tenacious Kojiro had been even as a child. Meeting eager questions with detailed answers, Genpachi talked on and on. "Isn't Gunryu-sensei here?" asked a young attendant, picking his way through the crowd. Not seeing him, he went from room to room. He was grumbling to himself by the time he came upon Omitsu, who was cleaning Kojiro's room.
"If you're looking for the master," she said, "you'll find him at the falcon cage."
Kojiro was inside the cage, looking intently into Amayumi's eyes. He had fed the bird, brushed off loose feathers, held it for a time on his fist, and was now patting it affectionately. "Sensei."
"Yes?"
"There's a woman who says she's come from Iwakuni to visit you. She said you'd know her when you see her."
"Hmm. It may be my mother's younger sister."
"Which room should I show her to?"
"I don't want to see her. I don't want to see anybody."
"Oh, I suppose I have to. She is my aunt. Take her to my room."
The man left, and Kojiro called out the door. "Tatsunosuke!"
"Yes, sir."
Tatsunosuke came inside the cage and knelt on one knee behind Kojiro. A student who lived at his house, he was seldom far from his master's side.
"Not long to wait now, is there?" said Kojiro.
"No, sir."
"Tomorrow I'll go to the castle and pay my respects to Lord Tadatoshi. I haven't seen him recently. After that, I want to spend a quiet night."
"There are all those guests. Why don't you refuse to see them so you can have a good rest?"
"That's what I intend to do."
"There are so many people around here, you could be defeated by your own supporters."
"Don't talk like that. They've come from near and far. Whether I win or not depends on what happens at the appointed time. It's not entirely a matter of fate. But then again, that's the way with warriors. Sometimes win, sometimes lose. If Ganryu dies, you'll find two last testaments in my writing cabinet. Give one of them to Kakubei and the other to Omitsu."
"You've written a will?"
"Yes. It's only proper for a samurai to take that precaution. One other thing. On the day of the fight, I'm allowed one attendant. I want you to go with me. Will you come?"
"It's an honor I don't deserve."
"Amayumi too."
He looked at the falcon.
"It'll be a comfort to me on the boat trip."
"I understand perfectly."
"Good. I'll see my aunt now."
He found her sitting in his room. Outside, the evening clouds had blackened, like newly forged steel that has just cooled off. The white light of a candle brightened the room.
"Thank you for coming,"
he said as he seated himself with a great show of reverence. After his mother's death, his aunt had reared him. Unlike his mother, she had not spoiled him in the least. Conscious of her duty to her elder sister, she had striven single-mindedly to make him a worthy successor to the Sasaki name and an outstanding man in his own right. Of all his kinsmen, she was the one who had paid closest attention to his career and his future.
"Kojiro," she began solemnly, "I understand you're about to face one of the decisive moments of your life. Everybody back home is talking about it, and I felt I had to see you one more time at least. I'm happy to see you've come as far as you have."
She was silently comparing the dignified, well-to-do samurai in front of her with the youth who had left home with nothing but a sword. Head still lowered, Kojiro replied,
"It's been 10 years. I hope you'll forgive me for not keeping in touch with you. I don't know whether people consider me a success or not, but I have by no means achieved all I am determined to achieve. That's why I haven't written."
"It doesn't matter. I hear news of you all the time."
"Even in Iwakuni?" "Oh, indeed. Everyone there is for you. If you were to lose to Musashi, the whole Sasaki family, the whole province, would be disgraced. Lord Katayama Hisayasu of Hoki, who's staying as a guest in the Kikawa fief, is planning to bring a large group of Iwakuni samurai to see the bout."
"Is he?"
"Yes. They'll be terribly disappointed, I suppose, since no boats will be allowed out. Oh, I'm forgetting. Here, I brought this for you."
She opened a small bundle and took out a folded underrobe. It was made of white cotton. On it were written the names of the god of war and a protective goddess worshipped by warriors.
A Sanskrit good luck charm had been embroidered on both sleeves by 100 of Kojiro's female supporters. He thanked her and reverently held the garment up before his forehead. Then he said, "You must be tired from your trip. You can stay here in this room and go to bed whenever you wish. Now, if you'll excuse me." He left her and went to sit in another room, to which guests soon came offering him a variety of gifts, a sacred charm from the Hachiman Shrine in Mount Otoko, a coat of mail, an enormous sea bream, a barrel of sake. Before long, there was hardly a place to sit down. While these well-wishers were sincere in their prayers for his victory, it was also true that 8 out of 10 of them, not doubting that he would win, were currying favor in the hope of advancing their own ambitions later on. "What if I were a ronin?" thought Kojiro. Though the psychophancy depressed him, he took satisfaction from the fact that it was he and no one else who had caused his supporters to trust him and believe in him. "I must win. I must. I must." Thinking of winning placed a psychological burden on him. He realized this, but could not help himself. Win, win, win. Like a wind-driven wave, the word kept on repeating itself somewhere in his mind. Not even Kojiro was able to grasp why the primitive urge to conquer buffeted his brain with such persistence. The night wore on, but quite a number of guests stayed up, drinking and talking. It was quite late when the word came. "Musashi arrived today. He was seen getting off a boat in Moji and later walking down a street in Kokura." The response was electric, though uttered furtively in excited whispers. "It stands to reason. Shouldn't some of us go over there and take a look around?" At daybreak, Musashi arrived in Shimonoseki several days early. Since he knew no one there, and no one knew him, he passed his time quietly, unbothered by sycophants and busybodies. On the morning of the 11th, he crossed the Kamon Strait to Moji to call on Nagaoka Sado and confirm his acceptance of the time and place of the bout. A samurai received him at the entrance hall, staring unabashedly, one thought going through his mind, "So this is the famous Miyamoto Musashi." All the young man said aloud, however, was, "My master is still at the castle, but should be back shortly. Please come in and wait." "No, thank you. I have no other business with him. If you'd just be so kind as to give him my message."
"But you've come so far. He'll be very disappointed to have missed you. If you really have to go, please let me at least tell the others that you're here."
He'd hardly disappeared into the house when Iori came rushing out and into Musashi's arms.
"Sensei!"
Musashi patted him on the head. "Have you been studying like a good boy?"
"Yes, sir."
"You've grown so tall."
"Did you know I was here?"
"Yes. Sado told me in a letter. I also heard about you at Kobayashi Tarozaemon's in Sakai. I'm glad you're here. Living in a house like this will be good for you." Looking disappointed, Iori said nothing. "What's the matter?" asked Musashi. "You mustn't forget that Sado's been very good to you."
"Yes, sir."
"You have to do more than just practice martial arts, you know. You have to learn from books. And although you should be the first to help when help is needed, you should try to be more modest than the other boys."
"Yes, sir."
"And don't fall into the trap of feeling sorry for yourself. Many boys like you, who've lost a father or mother, do that. You can't repay the warm-heartedness of others unless you're warm and kind in return."
"Yes, sir."
"You're bright, Iori. But be careful. Don't let your rough upbringing get the best of you. Keep yourself under tight rein. You're still a child. You have a long life ahead of you. Guard it carefully."
Save it until you can give it for a really good cause, for your country, your honor, the way of the samurai. Hold on to your life and make it honest and brave. Iori had the sinking feeling that this was a parting, a final farewell. His intuition probably would have told him this even if Musashi hadn't spoken of such serious matters, but the mention of the word life left little doubt. No sooner had Musashi said it than Iori's head was buried in his chest. The child sobbed uncontrollably. Musashi, noting that Iori was very well groomed, his hair nicely combed and tied, and his white socks immaculate, now regretted his sermon. "Don't cry," he said.
"But what if you..."
"Stop your bawling. People will see you."
You're going to Funashima the day after tomorrow?"
"Yes, I have to."
"Win! Please win! I can't bear to think of not seeing you again."
"Aha! You're crying about that?"
"Some people say you can't beat Kojiro. You shouldn't have agreed to fight him in the first place."
"I'm not surprised. People always talk like that."
"You can win, though, can't you, Sensei?"
"I wouldn't even waste my time thinking about it."
"You mean you're sure you won't lose?"
"Even if I do lose, I promise to do it bravely."
"But if you think you might, couldn't you just go away somewhere for a while?"
"There's always a germ of truth in the worst of gossip, Iori. I may have made a mistake, but now that it's gone this far, to run away would be to forsake the way of the samurai. That would bring dishonor not only on me, but on many others as well."
"But didn't you say I should hang on to my life and guard it carefully?"
"Yes, I did. And if they bury me on Funashima, let that be a lesson to you and avoid getting into fights that may end in your throwing your life away." Sensing that he was overdoing it, he changed the subject. "I've already asked that my respects be conveyed to Nagaoka Sado. I want you to convey them too, and tell him that I'll see him on Funashima." Musashi gently shook himself free of the boy. As he walked toward the gate, Iori clung to the basket hat in his hand.
"Don't! Wait!"
was all he could say. He put his other hand to his face. His shoulders were shaking. Nuinosuke came through a door beside the gate and introduced himself to Musashi.
"Iori seems reluctant to let you go, and I'm inclined to sympathize with him. I'm sure you have other things to do, but couldn't you just stay over here one night?"
Musashi, returning his bow, said, "It's good of you to ask, but I don't think I should. In a couple of days, I may be asleep for good. I don't think it'd be right for me to burden others now. It might prove to be an embarrassment later on."
"That's very considerate of you, but I'm afraid the master will be furious with us for letting you go."
"I'll send him a note explaining everything. I only came today to pay my respects. I think I should be leaving now." Outside the gate, he turned toward the beach, but before he'd got halfway there, he heard voices calling from behind. Looking back, he saw a handful of elderly-looking samurai from the house of Hosokawa, two of whom had gray hair. Not recognizing any of them, he assumed they were shouting to someone else and walked on. Upon reaching the shore, he stood and gazed out over the water. A number of fishing boats rested at anchor in the offing, their furled sails ashen in the misty light of early evening. Beyond the larger mass of Hikojima, the outline of Funashima was barely visible.
"Musashi! You are Miyamoto Musashi, aren't you?"
Musashi turned to face them, wondering what business these aged warriors could have with him.
"You don't remember us, do you? Didn't think you would. It's been too long. My name's Utsumi Magobe no Jo. All six of us are from Mimasaka. We used to be in the services of the House of Shinmen at Takeyama Castle."
"And I'm Koyama Handayu,
Magobenojo and I were close friends of your father's."
Musashi smiled broadly.
"Well, this is a surprise.